Hello and welcome to this week's The VFX Show. This week we're talking about Watchmen. I am John Flowers, doing my flat level best to stand in for Mike Seymour. And with me I have Jason Wingrove.
Hi, how are you?
Hi. Oh, I'm doing great. Thank you for asking.
Excellent.
So The Watchmen is a really interesting film, and it's interesting for a lot of different reasons, one of which is this is basically a comic book that came out in 1985 and 1986, and it was created by Alan Moore, and Alan Moore is kind of a popular guy in the comic book world. And what happened with The Watchmen is this comic came out, and they've been trying for a long time to make it. You know, it was owned by Fox, and then it kind of changed hands, and then there are all these issues with it. And, you know, it's been called unfilmable. I think a lot of people have said that. Alan Moore himself will not even watch it. He won't talk about it. He refuses to even acknowledge the existence of a film based on his comic book, which we have to, you know, start by saying the comic book is literally one of the most celebrated comic books ever created. It's right up there with Frank Miller's The Dark Knight, which is the story of Batman when he aged and what the world looked like when, you know, there was a superhero like Batman and he's in his 60s and he's just trying to, you know, hold it all together and the world's gone completely insane.
Did you read the graphic novel before you saw the film?
Absolutely. Yeah, I really did. So I should set up the story because it's a really complicated story. So basically, the story kind of takes place in a lot of different time frames, but it really sets up in 1985 in New York. There's a character, Edward Blake, who is also known as the Comedian, and he is one of the original Watchmen. The Watchmen were a group of superheroes, and basically this other superhero named Rorschach, you know, and none of these guys are practicing being superheroes anymore, but this other superhero, Rorschach, finds out that this guy, you know, the Comedian is dead, and he sort of suspects foul play. And then he goes on this kind of adventure, really, to try and figure out what's going on. Now, in this fictional parallel world, Nixon has been reelected a number of times.
Like the U.S.
The U.S. won the war in Vietnam thanks to Dr. Manhattan, who we will get into in a bit. And it's just this kind of crazy parallel world that, you know, where superheroes exist and some of them actually have powers, but most of them don't, right? Most of them just dress up and just try and be superheroes.
So I've come from the complete other side of the graphic novel universe, having almost never picked one up before. I've literally thumbed through the book post-watching the film, and it was quite amazing to see almost the storyboards for the film. So I came to it plot-wise knowing absolutely nothing apart from a few Twitter reviews. But it sounds like you've come from the other side, John.
Yeah, I sure have. And what's interesting about this particular story is, you know, Alan Moore really wanted to... So Alan Moore worked for another comic book company, and that comic book company was acquired. And basically, that comic book company was called Charlton Comics. And what Alan Moore wanted to do is he wanted to do this story, The Watchmen, but he wanted to do it with the actual comic book characters that existed in this universe. And what happened was the acquiring company decided that they didn't want him to do it because it would mean killing off like every one of their, you know, flagship characters, right? I mean, he basically wanted to just go in and take all the major characters in this universe and just kill them off. And they said, right, No, you got to create new characters. So that's why when you watch The Watchmen, you'll note that not a single one of the characters is actually a comic book character you've probably ever heard of unless you read the graphic novel.
Right.
So it's kind of fascinating. Anyway, enough about that. There's a lot of really interesting backstory that kind of led up to this. And it's, you know, it's a long and drawn out series with a lot of complicated plot lines. And in fact, the final movie, it comes in at over 2.5 hours, right?
Yeah, 2 hours, 40 minutes or so. And I can kind of understand why they said it was unfilmable, even after seeing it filmed. I found it really watchable. I liked it a lot more than I thought I would. Some really fantastic filmmaking in there, some awesome performances. But coming from that other half of the audience of the film, I found the gaps in the storyline And the backstory kept it all from going from great filmmaking to being a great film. It's obviously really hard for a graphic novel with such a scope of characters and such a huge universe to translate to even 2 hours, 40 minutes. But even though they did a great job of trying to cover that backstory throughout the film and in that awesome title sequence, I think it's just a little bit too much for my Winnie the Pooh brain to take in so much of it. And I think that really held it back, going from what is awesome sequences of a whole lot of great filmmaking through to being a good film. But overall, I really found it really watchable, really entertaining, looks fantastic, amazing, virtually faultless effects. Awesome use of music from the era and Bob Dylan and Simon and Garfunkel and everything. So it was, I sort of came away thinking, wow, I was really impressed.
So let's talk about the Bob Dylan-ness of this show. So the film starts out with what is really an interesting throwback look and feel of the title sequence.
Yeah.
And the title sequence, if you're listening and you just want to watch the title sequence, you can actually go to tinyurl.com/WM trailer, and there's a link to the opening title sequence. And the opening title sequence is quite long. It has a Bob Dylan song playing in the background, I believe Times They Are a Changin'.
Mm-hmm.
And it just goes on and on and on. It is, you know, probably the longest opening title sequence of any film I have ever seen.
I thought it was fantastic, didn't you?
Oh, it was really interesting, but it was shockingly long for an opening title sequence.
Well, I guess they wanted to keep it to the length of the song, I suppose.
And you see that. What's interesting is actually as you watch the entire film, you see that a lot. I mean, I was surprised at the number of songs that were used in the background while... Yeah. Some scene played out. And I think in a lot of ways that was Zack Snyder, the director's kind of wink to the era, right? Because a lot of the songs were, you know, from the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And I think he was trying to make a conscious point at a lot of this.
But also I can kind of relate to it, I suppose. A lot of the time, you know, you see like a little bit of film, a bit of musical kicking in the film for a scene, and you'll start to get into it, and then it'll just kind of fade away. And it's almost just like give you 10 seconds of this track just to sort of justify the fact that we're going to throw it into the soundtrack album later on. And it just sort of, and Zach's come from commercials and from music video, and he just really loves working with music, with the vision, I can only imagine. So yeah, look, keep that music going as long as possible.
And they certainly did. So for example, the opening title sequence starts in 1939 and ends in 1985, and it's kind of I hate to call it a montage because I don't think montage is the right way of describing it, but it's a lot of 2D and 3D crammed together and creating this, you know, this sequence with what I think are the kind of television show heroes' signature title effects, where the titles are actually laid onto something and then kind of move and interact and people go forward and behind them. I had not seen that kind of titling prior to Heroes Season 1, had you?
Not really. I mean, it is quite techniquey, but it really worked quite well for this. I mean, essentially what I think for overall, it, as you say, it felt like a really old world effect. It's because it's pretty much done all in camera, essentially, for those who haven't seen it yet. It's essentially all shot, sort of most of it shot fake slow-mo, where everyone's kind of acting slow or frozen moments. And the camera's constantly on the move, and it's almost like a series of photographs being taken. There's always a camera there with sort of slow flash bulbs. And it's sort of the fact that the flash takes about 5 seconds to come on and fade off again makes the whole thing feel like it's all shot at about 300 frames a second. Yet, obviously, it's not. But the fact that it's all done in camera feels very real and actually quite old world. And I think that really lends to the that sort of aging of the, you know, giving it that sort of retro feel to it. But yes, embedded within the scenes as people sort of cross in foreground and background are essentially the title cards for the film, as people sort of as the camera pulls back, the 3D titles are embedded in the scene essentially. So you actually kind of, as you track through the scene, you're tracking past the title card and revealing it, and then someone will cross and it'll sort of get wiped. And it's really, really, really very nice. Very, very, very engaging, I thought.
And this was done by, and I don't know how to pronounce their name, it's Y-U plus Co, so Yuko.
Right.
But it's kind of a clever takeoff on a color space, I think, the way that they've done their name, Y-U plus C-O.
Yeah, and they did all the 3D titles, yeah.
Absolutely. And they did a tremendous amount of that, obviously, opening sequence. And that opening sequence is interesting, too, because with regard to the special effects and the rest of the film, it really sets the tone for the kind of bloodbath that you're going to experience while you're watching.
It was a little bit bloody.
Because there are definitely some very specific and in-your-face moments in the film. And this gives you an example of it. I mean, when, you know, in the opening title sequence, you see guns going off and people getting punched and just the sort of blood spatter that, you know, happens after someone gets punched. Apparently really, really hard in the opening titles.
Yeah. I don't know how I do a lot of that. I presume it's a mixture of some real slow-mo, but also there have to be some effects going on there and distorting the face so much. Or maybe people are just happy to be punched. I don't know. Maybe there's people in the world, actors in this world, that love being smacked in the face really hard.
Absolutely. That's method acting. Go ahead and hit me as hard as you can.
Yeah, hit me. Can we do it in one take or two, please?
So this film, there were a tremendous amount of visual effects in this film. I don't know the full number of visual effects, but I do know that a lot of the visual effects were done by John DJ Desjardins. And he is with MPC, which is in Vancouver.
Yep.
And I know that they personally did about 250 shots, and they were probably most of the key sequences in the film. They did the CGI owl ship. They did a bunch of digital doubles, and they just did a lot of other visual effects in the film. And what's interesting about that is, from what I can tell, there was another visual effects supervisor in the film, Jess Norman, and Jess oversaw only 35 artists, and some of which were in London. So this was not, you know, by looking at it, you would think that it was just an enormous group of visual effects artists, but there were certainly a number of houses, but it seems like the number of artists working on this is much smaller given its size and the number of shots.
It does feel very single-handed, doesn't it? It doesn't sort of feel like there's 1,000 people involved. It has a very consistent feel, a very consistent look, regardless of whether you're doing, you know, miniature work or effects work. It all does feel very integrated, doesn't it? It doesn't sort of feel like it's been passed through the ringer to like 1,000 different houses. If that is the case, then absolutely congrats to the supervisors, because it really does feel very integrated as a film. Doesn't feel rushed.
It sure does not. And a lot of the work is, you know, kind of old school. I mean, you see a lot of stuff rendered by RenderMan, but you also see a lot of the compositing. I mean, a shocking amount of the compositing was done in Shake.
Yeah, which is pretty amazing, really, for something that's sort of almost, it's pretty much discontinued, isn't it?
Yeah, it's definitely discontinued, and it's been discontinued for a while.
Yeah.
But I mean, obviously, there's still a lot of Shake artists out there, and Shake is still used quite a bit, but I guess I haven't seen Shake recently used in such a prominent way, or, in, you know, I haven't seen it as the main compositing application in a feature film in quite a long time.
Well, what's interesting, I suppose, with the look of it is that you don't, I mean, obviously, I guess you're entering into this sort of, not unrealistic, but stylized world where everything's, it's okay for everything to be composited, really. You're essentially doing a visual representation of a graphic novel. So you have kind of carte blanche to sort of play with perspectives a little bit, and sort of get away with it. Immediately, obviously, with that said, you don't really sit there watching a whole bunch of effects. You really sort of get immersed into that graphic novel world. So, yeah, it does look like there's a lot of miniatures. It looks like there's a lot of a real mixing of foreground, miniatures, CGI, and it all sort of really at the end feels like it does have that sort of graphic novel feel. It does all feel like it's the comic brought to life, really. I know that sort of sounds very simplistic to say, but, you know, sometimes you can put all those layers together and it can come out just looking like a whole bunch of layers, but somehow all those disciplines put together in this feel like one, I suppose.
Absolutely. And, you know, while we're talking about visual effects and kind of going in order here, what did you think about the opening fight scene between the comedian and the as of yet unnamed or unknown assailant, where they just beat the hell out of each other and the comedian gets knocked out the window.
It's top of my list here of stuff I loved. That whole balcony death, window fall. This is some really iconic. Again, it's, you know, you open with a fantastic title sequence, then you go into this sort of the death sequence of the comedian. A bit of a flashback to that, and that whole the tumbling smiley badge with the blood, and you know, if you look at that sequence in the graphic novel, which I've done since, it's almost better to for me it was almost better to go that way, watch the film first, and then go and watch the graphic novel and look through the novel and go, wow, this is awesome. They're really, really, really true to it. Yeah, that was a fantastic sequence and really felt like a really great, again, that was one of those iconic, really great filmmaking sequences, despite it being a sequence of probably almost taken frame by frame from the graphic novel. It really, once it's translated into a film, it truly sort of played out beautifully, played out very filmically, and that's obviously a testament to the initial artists who are thinking, obviously have a very filmic brain, I guess. Did you spot the... I wonder if it was intentional, the nod to 300?
I did, yeah, absolutely, with the camera movement.
Well, then he was in hotel room 3001, and when he got sort of shot or he got killed, his coffee mug smashed against the door and the one fell off and it turned to 300.
Oh, yeah, I saw that as well. I thought you were talking about earlier where there's actually a lot of
300 blood.
Yeah, a lot of the blood and the camera work was... you know, a la 300. Have you had an opportunity, Jason, to see the before and after on that particular shot where the comedian goes flying out the window?
No, I saw a couple of the shots of him going through the window with the rig going through and the actor, Jeffrey Dean Morgan, on the rig being thrown out the window. It's all pretty impressive, but it looks like, obviously, the glass was all CGI or were put in later. It looks like he's flying out of the window, just all in one rig, and actually looks like he personally was in the rig and thrown out, not just thrown out the window on the flying rig, but also then dropped almost in one shot, dropped down, you know, a fair few flights even in the studio.
Absolutely. And this is the before and afters. I hope that they are put up on FX Guide, or I hope they're on the VFX show. I hope we have an opportunity to actually show those. The before
Where
and after
you
really...
see them?
I saw them. Someone from the moving picture company, okay. Sophie Trainer, sent them over to us.
Oh, awesome.
So thank you, Sophie. They're pretty awesome. But you really get a sense of, you know, the only thing in that scene when he flies through the window, the only thing that is real that wasn't manufactured was the character whose name just escaped me, even though you said it, who played the comedian.
Yeah, Jeffrey Dean Morgan.
There's
a lot of people I've never heard of.
Which
does help you pay for your effects.
Absolutely.
But there's equally, again, there's some awesome performances in there, but I digress.
So let's move on and talk a little bit about the owl ship. That thing is certainly front and center in a lot of the movie.
Yeah.
And the owl ship, of course, as stated, was also done by the same house here, MPC.
I mean, I guess I'm not sure how they shot it. I mean, I've seen a full size mock up on a gimbal rig on stage, and I'm aware there's some CGI, but I'm sure there's miniatures or something. But however they've done it, it's all pretty seamless going from full size mock up on set to CGI into backgrounds. It's again another seamless. Some seamless work there.
Yeah, and I have not been able to pull together the application that this was modeled in, or what they used to model this. But I can tell you, they absolutely had partials for the full size model. They had a miniature, and then everything else that you see is actually a 3D model. And a tremendous amount of when you see it flying through the water and coming out of the water and these sort of things.
Yeah,
all of the water and everything that you're seeing splash around it, and it's all manufactured.
Yeah.
So, I mean, they did just a phenomenal job on a lot of this. Now, I had to suspend disbelief a little bit because Obviously, in the rest of the film, there is absolutely no indication that they have the technology to create something that hovers, because obviously nothing else hovers in the entire film.
Yeah. Yes, he just, I think they just allude to the fact he's, you know, crazy billionaire, or someone made a lot of money along the way, and yeah, I just did this in my spare time in my garage. Shh, don't tell anyone.
Right. Try not to think too hard about it.
No, I wasn't. I totally wasn't anyway. I didn't even think about it. I didn't buy it. I just fine. Yeah, whatever. Cool.
So I guess a discussion of the film wouldn't be complete without at least getting into at some point the Dr. Manhattan work.
Yeah.
Dr. Manhattan, played by Billy Crudup, which is kind of interesting.
Yes, it was interesting that the pretty much the only sort of major star that they had was basically pretty much all removed from the movie.
Absolutely. And so I want to talk a little bit about that. So basically, Chris Gilman's team at Global Effects, which is an organization in North Hollywood, put him in a white spandex suit, but then put these blue LED and tracking markers all over him to kind of give a reference of the hue that he would be enveloped in, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, what's interesting, if you see, there's a fair few clips you can see around online of this, and the very minimal tracking markers. I mean, the main reason for the 2,500 blue LEDs all over his suit is to provide interactive lighting, so it can bounce off other actors, bounce off the room. And if you actually, since then, I've gone back and looked at a few other clips, and you can really see how this works, that if he walks through a scene, he really is lighting up the place. It's there's a lot of light coming from him, which there is obviously in the finished film, that you definitely get that sense that that he is luminous. And half of it is the fact that, yes, it's interacting on other people's faces, it's interacting on the other performers and around the room and around the sets. So there was, yes, I'm interrupting you, John, but from my research, there's 2,500 LEDs all over his woven suit. They could remote control the whole suit and also just create different zones in the suit. Like, they could put a bit more exposure on the back half of the suit so it could light up the set behind him a bit more, and a little less on the front when it was pointing towards the camera and they need to back it off a little bit. He had lights in the bottom of his shoes so he could actually illuminate the floor as he walked. But yes, that was mainly again for in interactive lighting and just quite simple tracking markers on his body. But obviously plenty of tracking dots on his face, lots and lots around the mouth. Perhaps we needed a few more tracking dots around the mouth, and some LEDs on his head. But really spent a lot of time, a fair few months developing that suit, and I think that did pay off. I'm still not quite sure about the whole CGI blue dude thing, but
And absolutely. So a lot of this work was, there's a proprietary piece of software that came out of Sony Imageworks, and it was used on Beowulf. And they use that same software on this show as well. And what's interesting is I thought a lot about this. I think it's kind of ingenious to light up the character who is in fact a character of light, yeah. and have that light be very authentic. I mean, you save yourself a lot of the problems that you would experience if you did everything in CG and then just did light wraps and tried to create illumination. I mean, they really save themselves a tremendous amount of the kinds of problems that you normally experience when you try and do something like this. However, I wanted to talk a little bit about the believability of the Dr. Manhattan character.
Yeah.
Because I felt like, you know, it worked in Beowulf because everyone looked the same.
Yeah.
But when I first saw Dr. Manhattan in The Watchmen, he seemed a little stiff. There wasn't enough movement in his lips. There wasn't enough facial expressions. There wasn't enough, you know, of any of those sort of things going on. And it immediately pulled me out of it. I really kind of wanted a little bit more. I don't know if this is just me, but I almost would have preferred if they had just composited the character rather than tried to create an entire character in 3D. Maybe I'm insane. Maybe I'm the only guy. Maybe I'm out where the buses don't run, and I'm the only guy that thinks that on the planet. But
no, I've got to say that probably the number one thing that took me out of the movie was his mouth lip sync. And if you look at the rest of him, the skin given the fact that he's pretty much all CGI and there's not an awful lot left, or I don't believe there's not an awful lot left of Billy's work. I think I was quite impressed with the fact that there is a reasonable amount of performance still come through. But just there was just something in the lip movement, in the lip sync, that just kind of just... I didn't buy it. We just got in a bit too close, I think, on that. And that just really kind of immediately just said CGI. All the rest of the body, when you see him in full shots, his luminous skin, then you can start to see this almost as amazing kind of little pulses and electrons and things buzzing around under skin layers. You can really get this sort of subsurface fabulous quality going on. And it all, the way he looked body-wise, it's all fantastic. But just as soon as we're getting close... when someone's talking, I think you do just subconsciously watch the lips, and I just found myself going, well, it was very Beowulf. And yeah, it just did take me out of it a lot. But, you know, I'm really not sure. I mean, if you had just like a really buff dude instead of another performer, you'd probably run up a couple of things. First of all, then you'd have to recreate, as they did with the LEDs, you'd have to then replace all of that interactive lighting. You'd have to create that. You'd have to be sort of faking that up and probably have to do interactive lighting passes with everybody so that you could then put... if you imagine, like, in his lab, he's walking through the lab. There's all sorts of props and equipment around him that... well, essentially, if you look at the film again, if any way you can sort of see the little scenes online, you can see his light is reflecting in everything. It's causing shadows as he moves from one part of the set to the other. The shadows move because he is the light source. So I think you'd have to, if you went with a real in camera buff dude, apart from the fact that it'd be quite all the harder to find somebody who was really built and could actually act. You'd have to again put all that interactive lighting back in again on top of it. So I think it's probably double-edged sword. I can see why they went this way, but like you, I think it's one of those things that did kind of take me out of it. But in a way, I kind of bought into it a bit more because again, I haven't come from the graphic novel fan side of things, so I wasn't sure what to expect with that character. I wasn't sure how close that was to the original artwork anyway. So look, I think it's probably the right, I think they probably did it the right, I'm sure they did it the right way, but I didn't totally buy the results. But look, you know, you get it. Billy's performances pull it through, even though it is quite a laid-back, quite a sort of internal performance. But he does help sort of pull it through, I think.
Yeah, I guess for me, I just wanted more of the Benjamin Button and less of the Hulk in that character.
Yeah.
And that was, I think, a big problem for me. But, I mean, let's not take anything away with it or from it. It was just phenomenal.
No, absolutely.
I mean, it's incredible work. And I do want to talk, we can't go the entire podcast without talking about the one thing that changed from the comic to the big screen.
Yes.
Having seen the panels on the comic, you know that Dr. Manhattan walks around naked all of the time. Let's just say that they really, and there's a interesting interview online if you Google for it with Zack Snyder. They really made a conscientious effort, or a conscious effort in this case, to make sure that everything was bigger on screen. And there's an awful lot of Dr. Manhattan on screen, an awful lot of the time. And Zack Snyder himself said that in the director's cut and the DVD release, there's going to be even more, and it's going to be even more in your face, according to him. So this reminds me a little bit, that particular aspect of the film reminded me a little bit of, the sort of 14-year-old boy fantasy of drawing comic books and then turning them into movies. There's just some aspect of that that I think they could have dialed down a little bit.
Yeah, I'd read far too many Twitter mini reviews and quotes about it going into it. So I was actually pleasantly surprised that it wasn't as bad as I thought. I thought, oh, here we go, 2 hours, 40 minutes of glowing nuclear blue penis, and it It wasn't as bad as I thought, but that does, Zach's comments are putting me off the purchasing the high-def Blu-ray extended edition then, so to speak.
Exactly. I came home from having seen it, and Laura Lee asked me, how was the movie? And I said, it's funny, the blue scientist spent half the movie hanging brains. So for those of you who get that reference, that'll be funny. You'll laugh out loud. Moving on from that.
Well, let's talk about his huge clock.
I think,
or
yeah,
whatever you call that thing on Mars.
The doomsday clock, basically.
Is that what it was?
Well, that's what it's sometimes called. But yeah, the big clock on Mars.
See, I think that was one of, I think those little leaps of faith in the plot-wise, which are one of those few things that maybe just go, what the? That's one of the few. Suddenly we're on Mars, and suddenly he's got this massive, maybe I sort of glazed over a bit, but it was never really explained what the heck that was. But it's basically huge. That's the Doomsday Clock, I guess. It's a massive, interactive, what looks like glass crystal, revolving, amazing kind of dark crystal-y kind of clock, I guess you call it. It's a pretty amazing thing. Obviously, all created, all CGI. From everything that I've seen, for everything on Mars, really, there's just a little bit of red dirt for the actors to stand on, and the rest of the time, it's just all green, a la 300.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's my issue with the clock is actually pretty specific, which is, you know, there's a phrase that is called the uncanny valley, and I've heard people use this, and in fact I think I've heard David Strepenis use it on this particular show. And to me, I truly believe that clock crosses the uncanny valley, right? It goes from believable to not believable, and part of the reason it goes to not believable is there's no reason for it, right?
But it's never explained, novel, right?
Yeah, but in the film, they just don't even explain it. And
yeah, that's sort of what annoyed me. But I would have said Uncanny Valley, going with Dr. Manhattan's mouth. But for me, it all felt really pretty real. Again, I'm just kind of like, yeah, okay, whatever, going with the flow. I have no idea what that thing is, but, you know, sit back and just sort of let it all wash over me. Look, I thought it was all pretty impressive. I think what was impressive with that was when it destroys itself, when it collapses, and I thought that was all quite impressively done. But if you didn't like it to begin with, you probably didn't like it blowing up either, John.
Well, and if you didn't understand that it was made of a substance that when punched would collapse like shards of glass, then you have no reason to believe it would collapse. No. And so you're already going, okay.
Whatever. No, I didn't. But it looked quite glassy and crystally. It actually looked like sugar glass. The whole thing looked like sort of that fake, you know, smash people over the head candy glass kind of stuff. And it was... So I already presumed that's how it would break up if it was going to do so. But so that's actually how it was. Is that pretty much close to the design in the graphic novel?
Yeah, it's close. I mean, you know, they took so many shortcuts, so it's really hard to say what's close and what isn't.
Sure,
because you
know,
you miss out. I mean, Watchmen could have really served itself well as a film to do two parts, a la, you know, Kill Bill, where you have a part one and a part two, because there's just so much going on.
I think that
and,
thought
like
crossed
said,
my head,
leaps.
Crossed my mind about, once we sort of kicked into the second hour, I was sort of thinking, what if this should have been in two parts?
Exactly. So I think one of the things we need to talk about, because I don't want to leave them out, is the Rorschach character. And the Rorschach character is interesting because there's actually, so the guy who inked and did a lot of the artwork for the Watchmen comic book is a guy named Dave Gibbons, totally talented, you know, just completely iconic drawings, right? And like I say, the Watchmen is a very celebrated graphic novel, so there you go. But there's a visual effects house that up until yesterday, I had not heard a single mention of them. And it's a company called Intelligent Creatures.
Right. No.
Now, exactly. So Intelligent Creatures is interesting. They're in Toronto as well. Well, in Canada, not Vancouver, but Toronto in this case.
Where the film was shot.
But it turns out, are you ready for this? Even though they haven't been any mention of these guys. They did 326 visual effects shots for the film, wow, up to and including Rorschach's face.
Well, if they did Rorschach, that is, I think that's probably pretty much my top best effect in this whole film, I'd say, Rorschach's mask. For those who haven't seen the film yet, it's, I mean, you've probably seen pictures of his mask, but essentially that whole thing evolves and morphs from what essentially they had 15 or so hero expressions or patterns in his for his, you know, the classic Rorschach ink blots. And basically, to shoot it, they had essentially just had a Lycra mask on with his eyes open. There's nothing, for apart from wide shots where you're not really going to notice the fact that it slowly moves and changes and morphs. The rest of the time, he's acting with a clean white Lycra mask on, and that every time you see it moving in the movie, it's totally replaced. There's no tracking marks. His eyes are there. They've removed his eyes and put the texture on, and it's just, I thought it was just seamless. I thought it was riveting. I thought it added so much to the character, and for a character who does not have their eyes, it added so much to the emotion. And really, sort of, as I say, they could have 15 or 20 sort of hero kind of key designs, mostly derived from the graphic novel, and obviously they could, as the emotion within a scene changed, they could morph it and change it from one pattern to another, and it really added so much to the film. I was riveted every time, and maybe that's a bad thing. I was watching the mask and not necessarily what else was going on, but I just loved it.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think if there's anything standout in the film, that's it. And I want to talk a little bit about, just briefly, so appreciate, you know, if you're listening to this, try and appreciate that they did a photoreal recreation of ink blots on a mask, which meant everything was replaced, which meant that the texture of the fabric was created, the lighting variations from him moving from side to side and everything up and down, running around, all simulated, and the shadows that were cast by his hat, the fedora that he's wearing, all simulated. So what you have here is exactly what you're talking about, Jason. You have a Lycra mask that is completely replaced with photoreal, moving, textured, shadowed, lit, you know.
Yeah, it was seamless, wasn't it? It was utterly
staggering.
Seamless.
It was just
going through interactive lighting, as you say, shadows, foreground passes, rain, you know, spotlights, you name it, going through it. I think there was two tiny little moments later in the film where there's a couple of little incidents where it didn't sort of quite track properly, but the rest of the time it was just through fight scenes and action, and you know, it was just seamless. I think there was a little bit of texture on even though that they used Lycra, obviously, so there wasn't any wrinkles, but I think that what they did was they photographed like a canvas, or photographed the texture and screen printed that onto the Lycra. So there was, once you got into close up, there was a little bit of texture there, and probably helped them at least get some kind of tracking marks on it. I'm amazed they didn't put a whole bunch of tracking dots on him, but it was pretty impressive. And as I say, it was a awesome effort in filmmaking, that with all that to try and get performances out of there, and there were some fantastic performances from the actor who played Jackie Earle Haley, who played Rorschach. I was pretty much blown away. I just thought it was impressive.
And if you'd like to see an unbelievable kind of before, just to get a sense of what this looked like, pop on over to YouTube and search for Watchmen Video Journal number 11, which is Rorschach's mask. And there's a whole 3-minute behind the scenes kind of what the mask looked like before. And it's just mesmerizing to see where they started and where they went. So maybe the intelligent creatures work, the 326 visual effects shots that they did, were all for Rorschach.
Well, there was a fair bit of him in there, wasn't there? He was essentially the sleuth, the detective character going through the film, trying to work out what happened to a comedian. So yeah, he's in a fair amount of the film. So yes, I could well understand there probably would be 300 shots of him. What else did you like in the film, John?
Well, I think we've kind of saturated a lot of the major visual effects shots and a lot of the major things. I think, you know, I could probably spend an entire show talking about Rorschach or spend an entire show talking about just different choices that they made with the owl, you know, the ship.
Yeah.
But, you know, overall, I guess overall, my perspective on this film is there's a hell of a lot of really good visual effects in it. And there are some plot points that are missing so completely that it makes the movie difficult to watch if you're actually trying to follow it. But there's one visual effects shot we haven't talked about, and I just want to mention it briefly. And that is the sort of lair on the side of the cliff where, you know, where the good slash bad guy is building a reactor that allows you to, you know, create what he says, create clean power, but actually it's generating signatures. Do you remember this, the sort of pyramidal? Yeah.
Yes, I do. But at this point in the film, I'm going, okay, where are we now? I don't understand I'm sort of going, huh? I wasn't really, yes, I was looking at the what looked like a miniature, but, I shouldn't say that. I can only presume it was a miniature. It didn't look like a miniature. It did look quite real to me. But to be honest, I was actually spending most of that time thinking, okay, hang on, where are we now? Where are they heading? The Rorschach and I think the Night Owl were walking towards the big sort of power station. And I just was totally going, okay, I have no idea where we are. First we're on Mars, this giant clock, and now we're back in, where are we, Antarctica? I'm not sure.
Yeah, exactly. And I think this is the one place, I think it bears mentioning, I'm not sure who did this, but this is the one place where it absolutely felt like it took me out of the film because it just didn't seem real like the rest of it. I mean, when you go from watching the owl and things going in and out of water and flying around and it just works to something that, like you said, you're not sure if it's a miniature, you're not sure if it's a matte painting, you're not quite sure what's going on. You know, the little things in the distance look painted, not...
Maybe that's just a whole... So. Maybe that's just to do with you know, your surroundings. When you're in, you know, the Watchmen world, you know, it's very classically feels like, even though it was all, you know, a set, I only know that afterwards by doing research. You have all this sort of classic references, and there's yellow cabs, and you have all this sort of reference as to where you are, and you feel sort of quite grounded. But then when you go to, you know, the giant kind of candy glass clock on Mars, and you've got power station in the middle of Antarctica on a cliff, and as soon as you do get taken away from the norm, then you do start to think, okay, how is this done? So it's probably, I guess, subconsciously, I'm trying to think, got the director hat on now, thinking maybe that 50% of that is plot and is surroundings rather than necessarily the effects, I guess.
Right. It's also possible that this was a choice that they made where they said, we wanted to, you know, look like the comic book, because it does look a lot less real or realistic than much of what else we saw.
Well, the other thing that sort of again took me out, which I thought was actually really done quite well, but again took me right out of the film because I thought, where did this come from? Was that kind of the kind of striped antelope-y lion thing? Antelion.
Antelion loper lion.
Whatever he was. Where did that? I must have missed a page. Okay.
No.
Did we see that being created? Do we see where it come from? Did I miss a bit?
No.
Okay.
No, it's
all right, fine. No,
the
baddie, no problem.
You know, the bad guy, you know, now that we know he's a bad guy, he has to have an evil, you know, familiar, which is a you know, kind of a spirit animal that watches over him and kind of
As you do.
Yeah, you know, as you do. Every bad guy has an animal kind of keep
animal.
Around.
Yeah.
I
absolutely.
Mean, you saw the Smurfs, the you know, the guy on the top of the hill had a cat. You know, it's just every bad guy has a bad animal.
Okay, right. I see. Okay.
So, you know, no, it was, you know, it just, maybe they, you know, materialize out of thin air and like they do in Harry Potter whenever you turn to the dark side.
Yes, that's right. You can start using all your power and money for bad, and you start conjuring up sort of mythical creatures just because you can. I've got the money. I'll have a antelope lion thing. Now, look, yes, that sort of did take me out. I mean, the other thing, I suppose, I made notes that were, that I really liked was when they were doing all of these sort of blue shockwaves, it started to explode, you know, New York, and started sort of detonating the explosions around the world. I thought a lot of those was quite well done. The whole Times Square shockwave explosions were pretty impressive.
Yeah, there are an awful lot of these explosions. There's a nightmare scene where two of the characters get blasted after they rip their skins off to reveal their superhero costumes.
Yep. Whatever.
And so that was an interesting one, because that was also a case where it was, you know, just two people shot on a green screen and everything else is digital, right? So, but you see, there are a lot of explosions and a lot of skin flying off and a lot of, you know, these sort of what I would, you know, refer to as the Terminator 2 effect going on. I think we all saw the sort of classic Terminator scene where Sarah Connor's clinging to the fence and, you know, yeah, the explosion takes her apart.
Yes, exactly. The sort of totally destroyed. And essentially, as per Rorschach's death at the end.
Well, you have to, right? And then, you know, you gotta blow things up. And
yeah, no, that was all totally impressive. I can only presume it's mostly in camera. With some, you know, obviously brilliant models to blow up. But look, I guess overall, the takeout for the film for me is the fact that the effects were not the thing that took me out of the film. It was the plot, and it was that gaps, and that's obviously from my point of view, not having known the backstory. So I guess the upshot is that the effects aren't the things that take you out of the film mostly, and they served the film really well all the way through all the multiple disciplines for every shot, all filled, integrated into one. It all did feel like a graphic novel come to life, which is essentially what this is. And so from that point of view, I guess it's, you know, two thumbs up. It's just very, very impressive. I probably will go and see it again at some stage. I'll probably see it on Blu-ray when it comes out. I'm not too sure about the extended version, but it definitely will be something I'd like to see again.
I feel the same way. I feel like, especially if the director's cut includes a lot of the missing components, because to me,
which I'm sure it will.
Yeah, I would be absolutely happy to see. I mean, it would not have bothered me in the slightest if this film were 3 hours long and there were some transitions between scenes that made some sense.
Yeah.
Because I kept thinking, if I had not read the comic book or the graphic novel, I would be so lost in certain places. Like you said, you just kind of appear on Mars and then you appear in the, you know, Arctic, and then you have an antelion, and then you know, there are all these things going on where there's just absolutely no transition between them.
True. But by that stage in the film, you just kind of go, yeah, whatever, that's fine. You just long for the ride.
It turns into Transformers at that point. All right, big stuff blowing up.
Sure,
let's go.
Whatever, no problem. The car can drive itself, no problem. I think there's something, I'm sure people will know more than me, but I'm sure there's some, there would have definitely been the studio pressure to get it under, I think there's some key thing of 2 hours 45, or there's some trigger point in the timing of the film that lets you, if you go over this certain point, then you miss out on that one extra, being able to fit that one extra session per day in the cinemas. So it has to be really worthwhile to go over the 3 hour mark or the 2 hour 45 mark or whatever it is to mean that the cinemas lose out that ability to have that one extra screening per day. So there probably was a little bit, I can only imagine there's probably a little bit of that pressure to cut a little bit back to get it under that time scale, and there's probably those few little gaps is probably what's missing. But look, as I say, it's still incredibly watchable, awesome work, very immersive, very, very engaging.
Do we think that it will make its money back? I mean, it seems to be sold out here like crazy.
I'm sure it will. I mean, it's been, I don't want to sort of cheapen the experience, but obviously films like this, and it happened the same thing with Matrix, which was shot here in Sydney. You go, you know, out of Hollywood to save a bit of money. You don't go with A-list actors, and you sort of try and get all the money on the screen effects wise, and be able to build the sets. Just physically, you have to make those not compromises, but you have to make those decisions just to be able to to be able to make it filmable. So look, I'm sure it was done for, I've no idea what the budget was, but I'm sure it was done for as little as it possibly could, to still be able to make it achievable. I'm sure it will. I'm sure it'll make its money.
So. According to sources, it's the production budget was $150 million.
Wow.
So we have to ask what that would be if it were quote unquote A-list actors. I mean, that's still a pretty giant budget, but
yeah. Look, again, I don't mean to take that away from any crewing or from performances, because as I say, there were some awesome performances. I'm sorry to bang on about it, but hey, director here, the whole, go and see it if you haven't already, not just for effects, but there is some fantastic work there from most of the performances, from most of the actors. The comedian crying scene and at the end pre-death for Rorschach, and I was sort of really, really impressed. So, you know, it does feel quite a balanced film. It's not just an effects film. It's not just the classic graphic novel. There's not an awful lot of amazing performances in 300. It's a very, very more visual film than this. This has got a lot more going for it other than just storyboard frames brought to life.
I agree. And I think we're going to see a lot more from Zack Snyder in the comic book world. I mean, obviously he started out remaking a George Romero film.
Which one was that?
Dawn of the Dead.
All right.
Yeah. So, 2004, Dawn of the Dead. And then he went on to do 300,
right,
which obviously is a comic book. Now he's doing Watchmen. And little known fact, I was actually trying to acquire the rights to a graphic novel by a guy named Matt Wagner, who created one of the graphic novels that I love most in the world, because I was going to adapt it into a film. And the agent that I was dealing with said, oh yeah, Zack Snyder already owns that.
Ah.
And so I was sitting there thinking, I bet Zack Snyder, after 300, just went around and said, okay, what are the 20 different comic books from the 80s that were just totally successful? I'm going to go in and scoop those up and attach myself to all of them.
Right.
Which, you know, good on him. I mean, he seems to be really great at translating from a comic book or graphic novel to the screen.
Yeah. So now I think one of the what was that one? Because he's slated to be one of the directors for Heavy Metal.
Yeah.
Now, I'm not sure. I'm not a graphic novel guy, but it sounds like this is a bit of an ensemble piece. They've also got Fincher and Gore Verbinski involved and a couple of other guys. So that is definitely going to be something to watch.
Yeah, and you probably saw the original Heavy Metal from the 70s, I guess, or
right,
early
yes,
80s.
Yes.
Yeah, kind of classic.
Yeah. Mm.
Well, all right. Well, so, I just to wrap it up, I guess I totally agree with you. I think it's absolutely worth seeing. Whether you love it or hate it, there's so many things about this film that I guarantee you've never seen on the screen before.
And hopefully may never again.
Some of which, yes, hopefully you will never see again.
Unless you buy the extended version.
Exactly.
And also, this film is also in IMAX, I presume, worldwide. It certainly is here in Australia as well, obviously in the States. So, yeah, maybe that's worth a look too. Go see it in... I'm sure it would be quite awesome in IMAX.
Yeah, I saw it in IMAX.
Right, okay.
So...
Yep. Well, maybe that's why you had the whole... Anyway.
Anyway. So, okay. On that note, I think I will just say thank you to our producer, Kristen Martin, and also to Lori Apthorpe, who does a lot of research for shows. We
yes,
thank you guys
you.
A lot. And this is a joint production between FX Guide and the Pixel Corps. And Jason, if somebody wanted to comment on anything that you have said, where might they do that?
Probably via Twitter, if you're on Twitter, twitter.com/Wingrove. Or probably you'll be able to contact me via my website, jasonwingrove.com. And how about you? If people disagree with your comments on glowing blue nuclear penises, where can they reach you, John?
They can reach me on Twitter at LifeZero or at my website, lifezero.org. All right.
Fantastic. Excellent. All right. Well, thanks, everybody. And look, any feedback, yeah, love to hear it. Suggestions for future shows, let us know. Thanks for listening.
Thanks a lot.